Welcome to Aetherius Radio Live, the Hour of Truth, with Richard Lawrence and Chrissy Blaze.
A very warm welcome to all regular listeners and those who are new to Aetherius Radio Live, which is brought to you on Body, Mind, Spirit Radio every third Tuesday of the month. Continue to discover the cosmic message for this age, revealed through legendary master of yoga and world-renowned medium, Dr. George King, between 1954 and 1997. Now, today, we're in for a very big treat. Your host, Richard Lawrence, will be joined by regular guest Brian Kniep, and they will be discussing The Voice of the King with some exciting new details. And I will say no more, except I'll hand you over now to Richard and Brian.
Nikki, thank you very much indeed for that introduction. And I'd like to welcome Brian very warmly to this special edition. In fact, there's going to be two. This one is part one, and next month will be part two of The Voice of the King. And I think I could speak for both of us when I say that we are excited. We are very, very excited because this is now out. It's now available as an audio book. And Brian actually is the person who supervised that project of making it the audio book that it is, with a very good team, both in the USA and in the UK. And the final result, well, is all I can say, I believe it to be the greatest audio book available anywhere and possibly ever will be. I don't know. We'll have to see what appears in the future. But right now, there isn't an audiobook like it anywhere on earth. And that's not because of me and Brian, not because of just the way it's written, or even because of the content or the way that it's narrated by us. It's because of the inclusion in it of the original audio sources, wherever they're available, of both Dr. George King personally and of the communicators who spoke through him. And in the case of mental transmissions, of him receiving those communications, and you hear his voice as he received it and recorded it. And this is completely new, and you won't find this anywhere else. You're going to hear on this audiobook great masters, such as the Master Aetherius, Mars Sector 6, the Master Jesus, the Mars Sector 8, Saint Peter, the Lord Babaji, an ascended master, Saint Guling, and it really is an incredible inclusion in it, as well as some incredibly powerful excerpts from Dr. King himself, not just in lectures and addresses, but when he recorded his own mystical pilgrimage, and he recorded commentary as he went in 1978 in the UK, of places he'd been in his childhood and in his youth. And we hear him talking about it during that pilgrimage. And you're going to get all those audio sources, or you do get them all. And I must say that people who've heard this have been incredibly moved. They say that they love the book, but this is an even better way to experience it. So there's 13 hours and 37 minutes on this audio book. And we are devoting these two shows to The Voice of the King, to this release of this audiobook and some of its contents. And as the authors and narrators, and as people who knew him very, very well and worked with him very, very closely, and being among his leading disciples, we're in a position to be able to throw hopefully some even more light, some facts and points that aren't even in the book about this. But throughout it, we'll be playing just a fraction of the excerpts that you're actually going to hear if you get the audiobook, which we do recommend you to do. I have absolutely no reservation in strongly recommending you all to get this audiobook. It's on Amazon, it's on Apple Books, it's not expensive. You can find it through our website if you go to the pages there, which the bookshop has, The King Who Came to Earth. It's all there with links. And I think you're going to have an amazing experience. But let me take no time here to hesitate. Toto, time to hesitate. That's not a very good phrase. But let me go straight on and introduce my dear friend, Brian, who's going to be presenting this with me today. So, Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Richard. It's really exciting and wonderful being here. And you're so correct. It's just an astounding work, this. I mean, if you think of the master's life, tremendous amount of dynamic range within his life, you know, from the alien mission to this beautiful visit to the Logos of Earth and everything in between. And it's but when you have a book, just the book I'm talking about his life is an amazing biography. But then when you add into it the actual voice coming through our master of these great beings, you're right. There's no way you can ever surpass such an audiobook as this.
Yeah.
You know, often when I look at transmissions or our teachings and I read them, and they're so beautiful and they really touch me. But when you hear them, it takes it several levels up. And to intertwine all of these extracts into this life of our master on paper into an audiobook, it just so many more dimensions into it. But to do that took an enormous amount of work.
Yeah.
And I do want to start by saying when I first was preparing for it, you know, getting the extracts ready with tremendous help from others, which I'll mention in a minute, and Richard was going to come over and do the main part of the narration of all the words that we wrote, which is the bulk of it, and he was only scheduled to be here for a week or so, and I'm saying that's not going to happen. It's not going to work. He's no way can you read all of that in that short of a time. And the person that we had helping us, the engineer Julio Monterrey, who's a trained engineer, he's a wonderful musician and just a wonderful person. Mm-hmm. He agreed. He says, I don't see how he can possibly narrate that in that short of time. It's a very large book. And we sat down. I'll never forget the first afternoon, the first morning that we went into the master's bungalow. And we sat down, and Richard was in the transmission room and behind a microphone and with the book, you know. And Julio and I were out there, you know, watching levels and kind of reading along with the book to make sure that he doesn't miss a word here or there, because it's a long book. And we were just gobsmacked that he just read this book just fluidly with like virtually no mistakes. And we looked at each other, how's he doing that?
Well, I think we all get help. And I must say, you and Julio were fantastic. And it was really great to work with you both. And also fantastic to be seated in the transmission room in the very spot where Dr. King sat and received transmissions. And you know, the technology that we had at our disposal certainly made it a fantastic experience, and the flow was there. And a school friend of mine, who I'm not in touch with, but I contacted because of this, is a professional audiobook reader. Mm-hmm. And an actor in England, fairly successful. And I actually spoke to him about it, and he gave me quite a few tips before I came over. And also, of course, I was told the big thing is not to get in people's way. So often, like, for example, when we're doing a service or certain types of event, then we want to read dramatically and so on. But he explained to me that they've got to hear this possibly over and over, and they might hear it many times, and they don't want somebody coming between them and the words. And that was a big key for me. So even though I'd written a lot of those words together with your good self, you know, that was my goal, to make it just easy to access, and you can focus on what's there. And then you have these gems. Now, I will say, thanks for that compliment, but Brian took the lion's share of responsibility for the audiobook. And you had a fantastic team. Perhaps you could tell us, or name actually, I think it'd be quite good to get this on record, some of those people in the USA and the UK who were on your team, Brian.
Well, it was. That's what I was kind of winding up to. We did have Richard's turned out to be an excellent bedrock of the audiobook with his very fluid narration. But it's always the rule, isn't it? The 80-20 rule. You know, 80% of the job takes 20% of the time, mm-hmm. which you did in this few days virtually, but then the last 20% takes 80% of the time. And it was that last 20% that was just
because we're talking January, sorry to interrupt you, January of last year, not January of this year.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. It's taken a long, long time. But, and the reason is that we have, well, like the figures here, we have a total of 236. The 236? Yeah, 236 total extracts in the audiobook. Mm-hmm. And of that, 163 were pre-recorded extracts. In other words, either transmissions by the Cosmic Masters to our Master, mental transmissions that were recorded, lectures or addresses that were recorded, and of course, quite a few extracts from the pilgrimage, Mystical mm-hmm. Pilgrimage. And these were, of course, extracts from many different times in his life, with many different microphones, many different backgrounds, many different recording devices, and you had to somehow get all of these found, cut, cleaned, and then woven into the background of your narration, and then also the ones that weren't recorded. I had to read, and I will say, I was amazed at how good Richard was watching him do it, and then I became more amazed when I had to try and do my part of the shorter.
I think you did it very well, Brian. That's and all credit to you.
Well, it's because it worked. Had a lot of work from Julio to do a lot of changes. But anyway, so we add all that together. It was a monumental job. And at first, I thought that it wouldn't be so bad because we have all these extracts and we've got the technology to do this and this. But when you actually do it and you have to make it sound as good as possible, it was very, very difficult. So I would like to mention some of the people, the main people. And of course, first would be Julio Monterrey, who was our engineer. So he recorded it live. And then for the next year and a half or so, I would go over there. I probably went over there maybe 10 times. Mm-hmm. And we would just work through these different extracts and work through splicing them in and endless. And then Richard and I would make a mistake here or there. Then you have to kind of fix that up, which was not easy.
He was great to work with, I must say.
And he was a lovely man.
And, you know, Richard, do you want to do that one again? You know, yes, if you say so.
Oh, yeah. You couldn't have a nicer person to work with. So Hurley did a superb job. Mm-hmm. And as a trained musician, he's an excellent jazz saxophonist, actually. Mm-hmm. And so he really had a lot of interest in the tonality mm-hmm. and the emotion, shall we say, of the project. Mm-hmm. Then I think another huge job was by Lisa Rosser, who put together the lion's share of the extracts and had to liaise with myself, with Richard, and with Julio, and with Jeremy to keep everything kind of
on
track.
Jeremy Curtis.
So Lisa did a phenomenal, and she also went through and did a fine tuning of mouth noises.
And I
remember she was saying after she'd spent hours and hours and hours of going through taking out mouth noises, she'll say she never wants to hear another mouth noise the rest of her life. Because it's a big thing with audiobooks is whether you leave the mouth noise in or out, because it's a long story. Then let's keep going. We have Barb Gajenski,
Barbara Galizinski,
Galizinski, thank you. She came in with a clutch at the end, and she went through it two or three times, which is, you know, it's a 13-hour plus book. She went through it to really catch any of the last mistakes and that kind of thing, which was extremely helpful. And we have, and then at the very end, we had Henrik Lövdakken jump in to try and Julio took it as far as he could as an engineer, as a musician, but then you have to get Apple and Amazon to recognize it, and you got to fit in the certain kind of weird things that they require. So Henrik, our technician forever in the Master's Day as well, of course, did his final touches on that. And then on that subject too, Julian Rosser came in to, because there was a mistake done by Apple Books, and he had to kind of sort. So a lot. That's that side of it. He took care of that. Then the a lot of other people helped in the checking and the working through it, and I'll just read them out. Jean-Pierre Aubry did a run through check. Of course, Noemi Bates did the artwork.
He's excellent at checking content as well,
and content
and artwork. The artwork is her design, as you artwork. Say. Yeah.
And then we had, and she also, I think she went through one of the early stages to make sure it was word perfect, which it wasn't. Right. So we had to work
That's
on
true.
That. That was a big job. Then we had Paul Nugent went through and did a check on it. We had Jeremy Curtis did a lot of work with checking it and also fine-tuning some of the sound, cleaning, that kind of thing. Gary Blaze and Oscar Leone had a piece way back in the COVID days, believe it or not. Wow. So, and I'm sure I probably missed one or two, so I apologize if I did.
But those are some of the people on an excellent team. So it's been a labor of love, but it's a fantastic bequest to posterity, for one thing, but also it's a living example of the essence of what we're calling the voice of the king, but the he himself, the master, the avatar, the great. A very advanced yoga master that, you know, we were privileged to know, Brian.
Absolutely. So it was a wonderful job, and when you listen to it, it really does take you to another place. The book, the biography itself was amazing because it was based on the master's life, of course, but then when you add into it all of these amazing extracts and our master in so many different guises and so many different times of his life. It's just, what can you say?
I call it jewel encrusted because,
jewel
you know,
encrusted. Beautiful words.
Actually, Dr. King once said that every transmission in the future at one time will be regarded as valuable as gems, as jewels.
Absolutely.
And they're all jewels. And this is, you know, so it glistens above the dusty tomes of world literature.
And there's a lot of those, aren't there?
There are a lot of those. It's not all rubbish, but they don't glisten with these gems. But this audiobook really does, and it comes alive. And as you mentioned, I think you said, did you say 236?
Correct.
Altogether.
Yeah. That includes the ones that I read.
Yeah. So we've picked just a selection, just a few of these, two or three of the audio ones for each chapter. And that's just out of the dozens that there are in the audiobook, just to give some idea of the potency and the power and the feeling, because with an audio of a transmission, you don't just get the content, not that that's enough, and the wisdom, but you also get the vibration, the feeling of the communicator, and the quality.
And the nuance behind the words.
Yes. Exactly that. And isn't it amazing, the consistency? You can hear the master theorist in the 1950s, and you can hear him again in like over 20 years later. Mm-hmm. Dr. King received, it's the same voice. It's very, very consistent, and indeed with Mars Sector 6 and the others too. And I think hopefully these two shows we're doing will just give some taste, some idea, and hopefully we'll also be able to throw some new light on some of this and some background to some of this. So we're going to bring in some new incidents and anecdotes, as I mentioned, and unless there's anything else you want to add, Brian, shall we get started with the first extract?
Let's get going.
Let's get going. So we'll start with chapter one, amazingly enough. So chapter one is called Growing into a Master. Now, this covers the early life of Dr. King. And his early life was beset, from his point of view, by moving, constant moving, partly because his father was a school teacher who had to go to different small, these are small little schools in those days, because he was born in 1919, for those who aren't familiar with Dr. King. And so in those days, there were little schools in villages all over England, and probably the same in other countries, I'm sure. And so his father would be put in charge of a school. He might even be virtually the only teacher in that school. And he'd have to move from, it could be in the south of England one moment, and then the next minute in the north of North Yorkshire, from Devon or so on. He'd make that move. So this is something I think he never liked, did he, Brian? Packing suitcases. In fact, he liked others to do it for him, but he just didn't like moving from, although he did it all the time.
He did it. I mean, the period of time when I was very close to the master, the last 10 years, we went up and back to Santa Barbara, you know, it's every couple of weeks. But we got it down so he didn't pack anything.
Yeah.
We just had it completely all packed up and away you go. But still, it was he didn't like it, you know.
Now, I remember when I first got to help him, which was like in sort of probably around about 1980, that sort of time, and I was quite nervous around him and quite new to him, and you know, in my what would I be in there? My 20s, I guess, yeah. So you know, we'd arrive at a location on a trip, and he just, oh, don't unpack, just leave it on the side, you know. He just didn't like, I saw early on, the suitcases being packed and unpacked, but of course they had to be. But getting right into it then, so in the summer of 1978, at the age of 59, he conducted a mystical pilgrimage of some of the locations of his childhood and made recordings as he did so on a portable cassette recorder, which were very popular in those days and quite new and quite people. Some of the younger people won't believe this, cutting edge technology, a cassette recorder in those days.
That's right.
And so he had all that. We've got it. We've now got it on reel to reel, and we've got it stored and so on digital format. But we'll start with one of the extracts from that recording. And this was made about a visit he made to a place he'd lived in called Lunn's, Wensleydale. Some people may have heard of Wensleydale cheese. It's that area. It's in Yorkshire. And I've visited. It's a tiny little village. And the schoolhouse is still there where he lived, actually. It's called Lunds, L-U-N-D-S. So this is an extract from, he made it on the June the 13th, 1978.
I cannot help but admit, in all modesty, that it's a long way between a young, small, sensitive boy walking the fells of North Yorkshire alone and the glories of Operation Sunbeam. Between the same child, rather sickly at that, trudging through the oozing wet fields and staggering back carrying a metal bucket filled with a drinking water from a spring about half a mile away, and witnessing the most elevated initiation offered to Earthman, that of ascension on a giant spacecraft 1,550 miles from Earth.
I think you can hear there, you know, almost his pain at some of these recollections. It was very, very tough childhood. But what he doesn't mention there, Brian, is the ill health he suffered from as a child.
Yep, he was very sickly.
And dogged him. He was born into a very ordinary family. His father, I say, was a school teacher. His mother had been a nurse, Mary King, but she was a very unusual woman, as was to find out later, with certain psychic abilities and so on herself. But a seminal incident, Brian, had occurred just before that in Devon, at a place called Littleham in Devon. And just referring to the book here at the moment, it was in Littleham that one of the key events in his life occurred at the age of six. He told one of his close disciples, Ray Nielsen, he'd been affected with an illness from which he could have died, which impaired his health throughout the remainder of his childhood, may have been caused by a devastating incident in which he was at this young age callously thrown into the River Torridge nearby and almost drowned. That was by some thugs, as we say in England.
Bullies.
And so this affected him, but it turned out he discovered on the mystical pilgrimage, and I think this is one of the big revelations in chapter one, there was a very, very good reason for this. I don't know if you want to touch on that, Brian, or if you want me to go into that.
Just before I say something on that, I'd like to go back. When I was listening to that extract just now and kind of visualizing him trudging through the wet, oozing moors, it reminded me of the great masters that you read about or in the 1800s, for example. And then they would go from that to become great masters. In a way, the difference, one difference with our masters, not only did he come up and become a great master, but he also mastered and reinvented into this world the advanced science of radionics. It's such a tremendous dynamic range of going from, you know, walking through oozing places in the north of England to inventing Operation Sunbeam equipment and then in the prayer party. It's just phenomenal.
True.
It just hit me. I just want to put that out there.
Cool.
But that thing that happened to him, which was and let's remember, he couldn't swim. So it's one thing to be thrown in the water if you can swim, but if you can't swim, it's a whole nother thing. But he learned, in essence, to rely on his strategic mind. Despite being a combatant from lives and lives before, at an early age, he was had that experience to force him virtually to rely almost more on his strategic brain. But add to that.
That's very true. And of course, it affected missions that he was later engaged in. And we go into that in a later chapter called Alien Armageddon. And it's very, very critical, I think, that whole incident. He had other incidents, and we certainly can't go through them all, one of which at the age of 15, we think he was 15 at the time, he had this incident where he bent an iron bar, about 18 inches, steel bar actually, 1 inch thick, about 18 inches long, in a physics class. And this took everyone, in fact, stunned everybody. He had to be taken out of the class. And he found out later that was a very early demonstration of Kundalini, because that could not be done. That was not possible, to bend a steel bar. The whole point of it was that you couldn't bend
it. That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and that's why it was being shown in a mechanics class. So I think he was around 15. He might have been a bit younger than that. But that was when he was at school in a place called Gisborough Grammar School.
Right.
And they moved to North, another part of Yorkshire, actually, there. But we must move on, because we've got so much here to get through. So one of the mysteries about Dr. King was almost always, and I think we all experienced this, Brian, those who were close to him, how much did he know as the avatar he was, and how much was that he didn't know because he wasn't allowed to know it in his earth physical body and the karmic limitations he was under. And particularly at the American headquarters, which I visited very regularly, I remember numerous conversations along those lines by people who work there, who work with him there. Wonder if he knows this, does he know that? Mm-hmm. What, you know, because it was always that enigma around him. He kept his cards close to his chest. But one thing he did understand innately from childhood, one thing he did bring into that life, he understood how prayer should be practiced. And it's something that we do in the Ethereum Society, and I think we can take it for granted if we're not careful, because it's not practiced in that way in many, if any, other organizations, certainly that I know of. So it uses the palm centers, it uses the heart chakra, and that alone makes it something greater immediately than other known forms of prayer. And I think it's interesting, we can hear in an extract now, the next extract we're going to play is from an address he gave when he was commemorating Operation Prayer Power. So it was June the 30th, 1979, and he commented on that.
Can I just jump in?
Sure, please.
It's another amazing dynamic range in that you have this master who brought prayer to a new level, really. And yet, at the same time, he was the master doing the most horrendous wars mm-hmm. as a combatant mm-hmm. Against this amazing dynamic range that he had.
Very true.
Another thing that amazed me was the ignorance about prayer. That absolutely staggered me. I thought everybody would know about prayer. As a child, I knew about prayer. And I thought, well, other lads don't seem to know about it, although I did. Maybe when I grow up, adults will know about it, but they didn't. And they had to be taught how to pray properly. I'm not going to say everybody, I'm not listing everybody, but the majority of people I met did not know about prayer until they heard the difference. When we were able to demonstrate what prayer was, oh my God, yes, that is it.
And that's so true. I mean, he was brought up in the Church of England, as I was, and people really don't believe it matters how they deliver a prayer. I mean, as long as they say the words.
Well, they don't leave in prayer, period, really, at the end of the day.
No, it's up to God after that. I've said the right words. And and suddenly we learn and we practice. And, of course, it's another topic, but prayer power has evolved immensely under his watch from when we started a fairly basic level to a very refined, pretty elevated level as it's practiced now. And that was all under his guidance. But I did have a couple of experiences, and these aren't in the book, actually, Brian, but I don't know about you, but where I actually heard him praying on his own. Mm. And one occasion, I couldn't hear what he said because we were in King's Cottage in Scotland, which is a missions base where we used to do missions. And I had the room right underneath his room. So I do remember after the end of a mission called the Saturn mission, some people will have heard of that, he did a prayer quietly, upstairs. I heard his voice coming through. I didn't hear the words, but the feeling in it was so intense and so profound. So it wasn't just something he told other people to do. I mean, he didn't know I could hear him even. I tried to put my ear against the ceiling, but that's difficult. But I heard a bit. But on another occasion, I was on Holston Down with him and another chap called Richard Casada, and just the three of us. And he decided to do a prayer. We just did a pilgrimage in Devon to this very holy place, Holston Down, North Devon. And we were hanging, Richard Casara and I, fairly close to him, but he wanted to go off on his own, but we didn't just leave him completely alone. So I did in that occasion hear him praying, and I heard what he said. And his approach, his real feelings, his real attitude to humanity came out in it, because he was praying for humanity. But he prayed in an absolutely no-nonsense manner. He didn't make any excuses, or let me just say, whatsoever for the behavior of humanity. He didn't try to in any way justify it. He talked about it as it was, and his it was done with humility. It was done with love, but it was also excoriating. It was no-nonsense, gently put, but devastating summation of the wickedness, the idleness, the, you know, the true essence of humanity, and then his prayer. And it was a, I thought, you know, this is a thing that, this was him and God, really, and I just happened to be lucky enough to be within earshot on that occasion. And it was very devastating indeed.
Well, we do have one or two, not many, but one or two occasions on recorded.
We do.
That are just phenomenal like that. And sometimes I'll even like put in these tremendous mantras into them. But you could take any one of those two. I only don't know too many more like that, and just really learn a tremendous amount from prayer. But on a personal level, in Santa Barbara, he would often bless these shapes up there. And so that would be a prayer and energy manipulation into the shapes. And he took it extremely seriously. He would put on an alb, go into a room, and he would get into this very, very gentle, delicate space. And he would go in, and you could hear sometimes a mantra being used, and sometimes some soft words, it was such it almost reminds me of when the Master of Theory says that, you know, the spark of God above the head is delicate and yet all powerful.
Yeah.
And you can almost feel the Master's delicateness, but just tremendous energy. And he would come out and just wouldn't say anything for quite a long time and sit down and have a cup of tea. It took him a while to come back from that state. And it is quite impressive. Mm-hmm. Not the right word, but it was an amazing experience.
Moving. You know, Brian, I think we're going to have to rein ourselves in because we've only done chapter one. we're halfway through the program, so more than. So let's move on then, please, to chapter two. So this chapter is called The Mission Begins, chapter two. And he didn't speak a lot about his 10 intensive years of yoga practice, which took place after the Second World War, that's 1945, up to the command, as we call it, on May the 8th, 1954, where he was contacted by the Master Aetherius, and his mission really began. He was very advanced yogi. He obtained many powers, including levitation, invisibility, conscious projection, healing and clairvoyance, of course, and especially mediumship, and that's what became key to his mission. But he was a shy person and a conservative with a small c person. He wasn't conservative in his attitude to the world. He was cutting edge and ahead of his time, but he was a shy and somewhat conservative person by nature. And he went through various tests, and this is a very moving extract from a lecture he gave in Kansas City, actually, on July the 3rd, 1959. So if we hear it, and then we can talk more about what it was about when we've heard it.
Another experience was this. I had to start, for some reason best known to the great ones, at the bottom. I was informed that the trance condition must be put before the people of London. But when the whole of the group, just on the verge of this first transmission going before the public, walked out and left me absolutely and completely alone, it was like adding insult to injury. But you see, this was another essential experience. And I will never forget my feelings that night when I walked into Caxton Hall, London, a lone little figure, looked at an audience who had heard about it and came along, went up onto the platform, and I thought to myself, how in the name of the Lord can I get this very, very difficult trance condition under these conditions? You see, one flashbulb at the wrong time would have killed me. One noise at the wrong time might have given me internal hemorrhage. This I knew and appreciated very definitely. And there I was, completely alone, or apparently so. However, a Aetherius, a Venusian communicator, was able that night to speak to London for the first time.
And that was a historic event. In fact, there's an argument that that's when the Aetherius Society really began, because that's when he went public. That was January the 29th, 1955. He always said the Society began in 1955, even though he hadn't technically been ratified by an AGM or anything. But that's really when things started. As I mentioned, here we have a man who was very confident. And this was always the strange thing about him. He was completely confident, while at the same time being kind of shy in a way and not really liking the platform, the public platform at all, unless it was just with his own close people. So the group he refers to is a healing circle, which he'd been running over a year, actually, in London. And, of course, he entered full samadhi. And I will say we have a transcript, not an audio, of that first transmission in public. And in it are some revelations, which we may go into on another occasion, about UFOs in particular and extraterrestrials, such as the fact that they can have invisibility. And with some of the things in there, not only that, there are other things in there which have been confirmed quite recently, by the way, in some releases from the American government, interestingly enough. So that's back in 1955. So because we've got a lot to get through, is there anything you want to add on that particular very moving extract there, Brian?
Just that it's one of those most touching, heart-wrenching stories you hear. I mean, to have that happen to him is
it's a disgrace, isn't it?
Makes your heart bleed, really.
Absolutely. Anyway, Dr. King has also revealed in those days, and we were touching on the fact he spent 10 years practicing advanced, very advanced forms of yoga, especially Kundalini yoga, it should be said, but others too. And his great loves were Raja and Nani yoga. And he understood Nani yoga in a way a lot of people don't, that it had to be the result of a deep meditation before you could really practice it properly. But he recognized immediately after the command that karma yoga was more important. Let me say, he'd always given service. I mean, during the war, for example, before he even got into his yoga practice, he was a conscientious objector, but he did practice this very potent form of prayer, and he did help in the relief effort. He'd always engaged in healing and so forth. So he was certainly a man of service. But part of him, he's admitted this quite openly, didn't like having to move away from the Raja, the Nani, and focus his entire life on karma yoga, even though, of course, he knew immediately it was much more important and that's what he'd have to do. So I'd like to now play an extract from a lecture he gave on May the 19th, 1961, which is, I think, quite revealing about his psychology at that time.
At one time, my dearest wish was to have a class of crack students who could work together to give various information to mankind, but not to be attached to mankind, to be detached from mankind, but have channels through which various information could be given to mankind, such as books and so on, but without becoming attached in any way. In other words, go into some retreat, some way, and become self-supporting. That was my dearest wish. But I had to face this fact in myself, that it couldn't be done. That the way of the monk is not the way. The way of the yogi who retreats is not the way. The way of the faker who stands gazing at the sun is not the way. You have to be all three. You have to be monk, faker, and yogi, and yet work in among mankind. And this is the most difficult thing to do. But this is the way in these days.
I'm going to hand over to you to comment on that, Brian, but I'll just say I think the word he's using there is often pronounced as fakir, F-A-K-I-R. And it's interesting, isn't it, that he does stress, though, you have to be the monk, the fakir, and the yogi, and yet work in a monkhood. It's not just enough to do the work. Yeah. That's the priority, but you need to keep that spiritual aspect alive as well.
Well, that's so true, and it's clearly something that he didn't really like, you know, and you can't really blame him because look at mankind that we have a very nice bunch of people on Earth, you know. But you could also say that he succeeded in creating a spiritual brotherhood that does that.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons, I think, why it's easy to find the Aetherius Society, and it's wonderful to read the teachings and understand it, but it's not that easy to be a long-standing member of the Aetherius Society, because this is a very difficult task. Mm-hmm. But he proved it through what he did, that this is the way that we have to go to save the world. And if he can do it, then we should also be able to do it as well.
Absolutely. And I think I'm right in saying he had a favorite film title. Was it The Man Who Never Was, or The Man Who's Never There, or it's a war movie?
All right.
It's a film title like that, but he always sort of saw himself. He liked the idea of being that, pulling the strings and help, you know, but being behind the scenes, as it were. And in many ways, he was. He did far more than we or anyone.
Oh, my God.
But we must move on. To chapter three.
Chapter three.
Primary terrestrial mental channel pluperfect. And here, this chapter looks at the incredible range of cosmic masters from different planets who spoke through him. We also look at the completely unique trance condition he adopted in order to take the cosmic transmissions. And I want to stress that word unique, because unique is a word that's used a lot. But in this case, I think it really does apply. I mean, as you know, Brian, I'm very much into mediumship myself, and I've looked into a lot, studied mediumship and other people who've practiced it. And I honestly believe that what he did, no other medium that I know of, certainly not me, and no other that I know of, even claims to have adopted the type of trance condition that he used to get that kind of accuracy, that kind of elevated transmission, the caliber of the individuals that spoke through him, the beings that spoke through him. And in a lecture on November the 23rd, 1963, he gives an insight, it's an amazing lecture, into taking such a transmission which involves communications from a number of different communicators and sometimes even overlapping each other. I won't say more about it now. I'll let you hear the extract. It's quite a long one. But it's so good, it can say far more than either Brian and I could possibly say about the trance condition he adopted.
It's a yogic type of trance which is brought on by a direct conscious manipulation of kundalini. I allow myself never more than 2 minutes to get into this condition. Never more. I can do it in 30 seconds if I'm pushed. At the moment, I will not reveal the mechanics, even the mental mechanics of this particular manipulation, because it is dangerous. It has never been demonstrated before, this type of condition. A beam is tuned into. Now this beam, well, it varies between the size of half a dollar piece. In England, it would be about 2 and sixpenny piece, to something about the size of a dollar piece, which is a little bigger. It's actually twice as big. It varies between that. And inside this beam appears to be quite a bright, bluish, pinkish light. And it is that which I have to concentrate on for however long the trance condition lasts. If I lose that, I lose the whole communication, and the whole thing would be then jumbled. There is more than one beam existing at the same time. when there is a fluctuation between, for instance, Mars Sector 6 and another operator, I have to move quickly between a beam which seems to have a physical position about 6 inches in front of the head to one that might have a physical position of, say, a yard, probably 2 feet, I mean, to the side of the head. So it's an immediate switch of consciousness from one to another. Such a switch could not be done by the conscious mind, so it is affected or brought about more by the super consciousness.
You know, one could really go into that and just focus on that, because there's so much in that. That's a particular state for a particular type of transmission. Some of the fundamental principles apply anyway to his cosmic transmissions, but some are specifically about taking a special power transmission. Would you like to explain briefly what that is, Brian?
And it's a surprising number of them as well. And we don't really study them yet that much in the Aetherius Society, other than, of course, July the 8th. But power manipulation is a way of, in those days especially, the late 50s, early 60s, where the cosmic masters were able to send extra energy through the adepts often to the Earth. And sometimes they would go to the Mother Earth, sometimes would go to the mankind. And it was an extremely complex manipulations would take place. Normally coordinated by Mars Sector 6. And it was clearly a way of getting the energy absorption to a higher degree as quick as possible, using the karma of the adepts and other beings to really fast track us out of this really dangerous zone that we were in. And then it fairly quickly stopped doing that, and then other things took over. But it was it's something that we will be getting into more of a study of.
Indeed.
In the Aetherius Society sometime in the future, because it was, for whatever reason, they were recorded very, very accurately. And there's a tremendous amount of technical stuff in there, which just goes right over our heads. Mm. You know? Mm. Be fascinating at some point.
I love the moment in that talk where he corrects himself from a yard to 2 feet, which goes to show just how precise he was. Not 3 feet, 2 feet. And this is a real, it shows what a real description he's sharing with us there.
Yeah.
But we'll have to move on. We're actually going to play an extract now from one of the cosmic teachings. And the thing about the cosmic, one of the things about the cosmic teachings, if we accept them into ourselves, into our consciousness, they grow. And from them, a whole range of realizations spring forth in our consciousness, and they lead to higher thoughts and other thoughts, and they evolve.
Absolutely.
And I've definitely found that Absolutely. Over the decades, and particularly in the last few years, actually, as never before. But there really is nothing anywhere which comes close to these teachings, and Mars Sector 6 really spells that out in this extract on July the 21st, 1964.
Search as you will. Throughout the world, we refer to as Terram, you will never find a greater teachings, more simply given, a greater truth with less a distortion than you find in and through a mental channel number one.
That's, you know, that is just says it all, and I'll pass to Brian, but I will just say there's a little thing not to miss. He says you will find in and through mental channel. It's not just talking there about the transmissions, but the wisdom that's actually coming from Dr. King himself, which he played down, and he never put it in the same category as a transmission. But actually, some of the lectures he's given, for example, on the 9 freedoms, the 12 blessings, and many others, are tantamount to transmissions in the quality of the teaching you get.
No, it's an extremely pithy, if I can use that word here, transmission. And it's, could almost say it'd be good on the beginning of the website, you know, because enter through this website and you will find the greatest teachings ever given to the world, you know, without distortion. And what you said earlier was true too. The, you know, the more that you study these, read them, listen to them, let them contemplate on them, think about them. They just keep expanding and expanding and expanding, and you get all cross references and cross pollinations, and it's just such a glorious trip through enlightenment is what it is.
Absolutely,
and we're so fortunate.
Indeed,
I could go on for a long time, but we have more things to do, don't we?
We do, and that's causes why Aetherius Radio Live exists as a show, because of the caliber of these teachings. And that reminds me, I'm sorry to say that this brings us to an end of part one. Our time is up for this month, but we look forward to carrying on next month. And before I get into any trouble with our producer, I shall thank you, Brian, and hand over to Nikki for her closing announcements.
It's been a real pleasure, and thank you for your work to get it all guided the right direction, Richard.
Well, wow. Thank you, both of you, so very much, Richard and Brian, for revealing so many insights into the audio book of The King Who Came to Earth, and we are all certainly looking forward very much to part two. Just a few announcements. Monday, November the 4th at 12 midnight GMT, we will be blessed by the presence of the Shining Temple of Light, satellite number 3, when it comes into orbit of Earth to imbue us with its vital spiritual energy, potentizing all spiritual actions by a factor of 3,000 times, and will remain in orbit until December the 10th. Thursday, November 7th, lecture entitled Karma Yoga and Reincarnation, the Key to Improving All Conditions in Your Present and Future Lives, presented by Gino Schaldoni at the Eastern USA branch in Royal Oak, and starts at 7:30 p.m. Saturday, November the 16th, a spiritual experience event at the Aetherius Temple in London, starting at 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. GMT, entitled Experience the Inner Peace of Yoga Breathing, presented by Ayub Malik. Full details of these and other activities held by the Aetherius Society at our centres worldwide, please visit aetherius.org. And please, please join us on November 19th for the next Aetherius Radio Live show, The Voice of the King, Part 2, with Richard and Brian. And I would certainly say, I mean, you can connect with your host, Richard, through his website, richardlawrence.co.uk, Chrissy through her website, chrissyblaze.com, and also with Brian through his website, briankneep.com. And I would urge you, really, it is absolutely superb, to secure your copy of this brilliant audiobook, The King Who Came to Earth. Go to aetherius.org shop and click on the image of The King Who Came to Earth, which will lead you to the links for Amazon, Audible, and Apple Book. You will not be disappointed. A fantastic investment, a truly amazing experience to listen not only to the narrations by both Richard and Brian, but more importantly, which is the exciting part of this audiobook, is to actually hear Dr. King's voice and the different cosmic intelligences who communicated through Dr. King. Absolutely wonderful, fantastic. Go out and buy it now. We hope you enjoyed the show, and we really thank you for listening, and we look forward to your company next month.